It's being recorded. It's the Nederland Fire Protection District Board of Directors special meeting on September the 9th, 2020. Start out with a roll call. Ian Owen Powell, I am present. Patrick Richardson.
Present.
Give me 1 second. Technology failure. Todd Riesler.
Present.
Ray Willis. Ray, are you present for the record? Ray, we can't hear you if you're talking.
Are you calling for me? I'm present.
Okay. Henry is absent, busy. Chief Des absent. So call the meeting to order at 19:04. If the board approves, there's meeting minutes from the 19th, which we weren't able to approve in the last meeting. Give me a second. It disappeared somewhere. So they should be up. So the change to these meetings, I mailed them out last night, is Henry's statement, which I will read into the record. So public statement from Director Henry Zerbrug by email. I find the current actions of the board towards the chief incredibly insensitive and lacking any kind of compassion. It is painstakingly obvious that the new board is trying to find any possible way to dismiss the chief, as it was promised to the few supporters during the campaign. As it has been proven with earlier cases against the chief, there was never any proof that would support your claims. You are displaying a vindictive nature in your proceedings, which I cannot tolerate. I am certain nobody is without fault, but good leadership team finds a way of making these challenges a teachable experience versus an undermining effort to sabotage the chief's authority. In case it comes up in the meeting, I'm against any suspensions or further punitive actions against the chief on this matter. A larger investigation is still warranted and desired, could be conducted, and the results further discussed. I am not sure this would be a good use of the taxpayers' money. I'd like to make a motion that we pass those public minutes so they can be made public and distributed.
Ian, could you show again real quick how that is titled, public statement from... Was that a public statement?
Yes.
Or was it a...
It's a public statement from Director Henry Zerbrug. He asked it to be added to the minutes.
Okay. Thanks.
Do I have a second to approve this?
Yes. Second.
Todd, do you approve them?
Yes.
And Ray, do you approve them?
Yes.
Thank you. I will send them to Jim and he can publish those. Okay, so the full purpose of this meeting, I know we have public members on, if there's anybody who'd like to make a statement or comment, please do so now. Okay. So the purpose of this meeting is really just to check in on the operational status of the department. The board meeting last week created a
rather large amount of confusion regarding what the expectations are for the shift officers. So they've requested some clarification for that. Also in the meeting, I suggested that we would have to have more frequent meetings to ensure that the board was being kept up to date and the decisions were being made in an appropriate manner. So that's tonight. So I have a couple of things that were added to the agenda, kind of last minute, that just came in today from the shift officers. Just so you know about them, some changes to our COVID-19 policy, some clarification regarding training. Some equipment purchases, and then some issues regarding 5617 that need to be resolved. So, this basically was a statement from the shift officers. So, in order for the department to continue running, as the board needs to clarify for the shift officers the following items and how they want them to do them. So I think the first one is obvious, which is continue to run calls and training as normal. I assume we have no issues with that one. Continue with the station cleanup projects already agreed upon prior to August the 19th, which would have been the medical closet, which is now been emptied and restocked. And the equipment locker, which has had all the equipment from, I believe, before 2014 removed.
Some of can I ask a question, Ian?
Yes.
Can I ask a question? In the process of cleaning up these different areas, you know, maybe this is after the fact, but had the team actually taken pictures before and after, possibly? Because it'd be nice to maybe present that to the board as these things are happening. Just a question for the shift officers or any of the firefighters present that are involved with this.
I don't know if they did, if anybody has a comment on that.
Well, if any of that was taking pictures of Todd, I apologize.
Oh, no, I just thought it'd be nice if that was the case, but just thought I'd ask. Thank you, Charlie. Go ahead, Ian, I'm sorry.
Okay, and I guess the clarification there is also with the cleanup projects. At the moment, the items that are ready for disposal are sat in the bay. So they need some clarification about what to do with those.
So are these all items that don't meet the NFPA requirements for lifespan, or they've exceeded their lifespan?
Yes, some of them by more than double, I believe. But they're there for inspection if any of us would like to go and check them and verify that.
This is Ryan. Can I comment?
Sure.
So, no, we did not remove all the items that were, I'm trying to think of how older than 2014.
Okay.
We removed everything that was older than 20 years older is gone.
Okay.
Apparently, the last two large purchases of bunker gear previous, we had some purchases in 17, some purchases in 13. Previous to that, last time we bought stuff was 2001 and 2003.
Okay.
So 2001, 2003 is still way outside of NFPA guidelines, but if I got rid of stuff that is truly out of NFPA, we would have two extra pairs of bunker pants in a closet, which I'm okay with.
Hey, Ryan, that you said you had obviously a 2001, 2003 gear is way out. What was the next date?
2013.
13. how many sets of that, and can you use that just to issue temporarily the new folks before they go to Academy and buy us some time before we can, until we can actually purchase gear?
No, all the 2013 and 2017 is in use. The only pairs I have at backstock are two pairs of bunker pants. That's it. Everything else is issued and in use.
When's the next Fire Academy coming up that's realistic that we could get, you know, four or five people to?
February.
Kind of a budgeting question. The roughly $5,000, Ryan, that you said we needed to outfit new members, was that the exact bunker gear spec that you're currently using?
No, I could not get a hold of that vendor, but it's in line with the last quote I used for a grant. So it's not 100% accurate, but I would expect it to be probably within 10%. You know, I always, when I quote, make quotes of numbers, they are generally high and I can beat them by a bit, because that's just easier than coming back and asking for more money. It's a lot easier to understand than overspend.
So the board, the board did see the numbers for the bunker gear and new recruits at the last meeting. I think it might have been a bit of a surprise about how much that costs us. But we need to consider how we're going to make that happen.
And remind me, was it at 11 put new recruits in the pipeline?
I think in total, that's correct. Yeah, sounds about right.
Something like that. And then,
yeah.
And then we would be, since we only have two pairs of bunker pants extra, sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, then we have somewhere in the neighborhood of $55,000 of bunker gear if all those recruits made it to Fire Academy, I guess you could say. That's my understanding, correct?
So Todd, just for clarification, it could actually be as high as $10,000, depending on which way you do, because bunker gear only covers structure firefighting. So to equip someone with wildland gear, that costs another $2,000 per person. And EMS gear is kind of a little bit vague. If it's kind of hard for me to really, if you're doing, I have those prices written out that if we have someone that just wants to do EMS only, we can buy like a lighter cut-proof version of bunker gear to equip them with for vehicle extrications. So outfitting someone from EMS can be a lot less. But if someone wants to do structure and wildland, that number is going to be somewhere around 7,500. But this is countered with maybe not of the 10 recruits that are thinking about joining us, maybe only five want to go to Academy. But I think the board needs to kind of decide how many people they want to recruit as structural firefighters next year, as wildland firefighters, and as EMS personnel, because each one has its own separate category. There is cost savings if someone does all three, then it would not be the full 10,000, but don't know.
Okay, thank you, Ryan.
Sure.
And there's a clarification item later about new volunteers, so we can possibly cover that there, but that's the, those are the rough costs that Ryan supplied to me for equipping firefighters and EMTs. So.
Mm-hmm. That's what I remember, like 10K or so.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we can circle back up on this one in a second, because it's probably going to be another, it's going to be covered later. So I'm assuming that we wish for the shift officers to continue with the vehicle maintenance projects already agreed upon. 5617 is already in the shop, and the last one to go, I believe, is 5603. And then any ongoing vehicle maintenance projects like daily checks and minor repairs. So any issues with that?
No,
not for me.
Yeah.
No.
Volunteer scheduling, I'm not sure if anybody wants to expand on that one. See if that's ensuring we try and have coverage from volunteers. But tell me more. Okay, then. I see. Let's say continuing project of trying to get the volunteers to commit to some scheduling so we know what coverage we have.
Are they actually going on a Google Calendar now and making themselves available on the Google Calendar, or how are we doing it now?
We have a Google Doc that they're signing up on, which is kind of working. It's a different way we're trying, I think. I don't know if there's a bigger plan.
Okay. Coming back full circle to the bunker gear, is there a need for equipment that is close to, what, two decades old now?
This is Ryan again. I have no issue with disposing of that because to me it's kind of a little bit of a false sense of security. I just kind of started by setting benchmarks and I was like, let's see what is 20 years plus. And all mm-hmm. of that was there. And now I'm like, okay, the next slice is 2003 or older, which that stuff's pretty beat. It's not really in good shape, but I'm just kind of was doing it incrementally and looking for guidance. If we're truly going to follow NFPA, then yep, it all goes.
I can tell you still some people that have the O2 stuff in their lockers.
Do they have two sets or that's their primary set?
Well, it's their primary set, but I mean, we're also talking, I don't think anybody who's a certified firefighter has them in their locker, but I mean, I think we have some people that just have them, you know, if they're going to do, I guess, traffic control or whatnot.
Hardly anybody has two sets. The only person that I know of that has two sets is Chief Durr. That's it.
When was the last time the 20-year-old equipment had been used?
As Charlie just kind of hinted, you know, we still have some people having 19-year-old stuff in service. But some of the other equipment, we try to get the newer equipment out on our volunteers, but a lot of it's just been sitting in storage. And again, providing that false sense of security of we have tons of equipment, but it's so old and so mouse-eaten that it's really not any good for anything.
So as you're saying, it's not used at all. It's just sitting in storage and that's it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Through two separate grants we wrote, we were able to get all of our active members' stuff and pull most of the old stuff off. But, you know, it is a question of sizing, which some folks that have gear right now, it's not the ideal size, but it's good enough. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's that old and it's been just sitting not being used and there's no foreseeable use for it, I would say we should dispose of it and eliminate that false sense of security because it's not usable.
Well, to fully follow the NFPA, then everything older, 15 years or older, would be gone, which we can do because that would eliminate. So that would be all the 2001 and 2003 stuff.
Well, it seems like we need a stopgap until we get better equipment in place.
So I'm looking through the bunker room right now, and what I'm seeing is I have, so we have Jay Hill's got old gear, or at least an old jacket. I think actually he has Patrick's old pants. He does. He's got Patrick's old pants. Bill's got probably 30-year-old gear. And we have one other applicant's locker. I don't know who it is that has some, it looks like O2 stuff. And so that stuff, whether you want to, you know, I mean, those people have old gear. So I think the only concern that I would have is, you know, just stripping people of their gear and not replacing it. I think that sends a weird message as well.
Yeah, there's a little bit. And well, neither of those two are firefighter one certified, are they?
No, I mean, that's true. It's just, again, I just don't want to send a weird message that we're taking their gear away and not replacing it with anything.
Yeah, no, I wasn't saying that. I was just checking that we're not going to put them anywhere where they would be using that gear. In an IDLH situation, say.
Absolutely.
Okay. I would go with the stuff that's in the equipment closet. We should dispose of, because, as discussed, false sense of security. And then we need to come up with a plan for how we replace the rest of the gear, which we currently do not have.
Ray, what's your take on it, Ray?
Excuse me. I'm just not sure how. I mean, somehow we have to find a funding method.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not opposed to getting rid of real old stuff that's well beyond its life. But we don't have an immediate funding method to fix this.
We do not. We're still waiting on the recruitment retention grant, which I think would cover the any new people, but I don't think that would cover old people. So we've got gear that is now 7 years old. So we need to start thinking about replacing that at some point, or how we're going to replace that in the future.
So are we really talking about two separate things? We have gear that is well past its useful life and should not be in service. And we can dispose of that, but the bigger crux, I mean, that's seemingly the easy question that's asked. The crux is, you know, finding the money in next year's budget cycle to at least come up with five new sets of bunker gear and start over the next 3 years budgeting to replace in cash, if we don't get a grant, however many sets of gear we bought in 2014.
Yeah.
So there would be really two separate budgets written, one for purchasing gear and then a fund set up to replace gear in 3 years. So we can, if we don't get a grant, we can actually have cash set aside to actually make that purchase without worrying about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Who awarded us the money for the last grant on bunker gear?
Ray, I didn't understand you. That was Ryan. A question about grants.
Who awarded us the money on the last grant for bunker gear?
The last two grants we got for bunker gear was FEMA through the Assistance to Firefighter grants.
FEMA also is the ones that we got the last set of SCBAs from, isn't it?
That is correct. So and the same grant cycle is where I have two outstanding grants for bunker gear right now. So the recruitment and retention, which would be about money for
I believe 20 firefighters, if not more. I don't have it in front of me.
Plus yeah, I think equipment. That's
what you did. It's a lot. And then I have a second grant out there also under a different branch of FEMA AFG for, I believe, 8 or 10 sets of both wildland and bunker gear. But they could be announced anywhere from Friday to next year. And we could just as well lose them and not get anything.
So is everybody okay with getting rid of the almost 20-year-old equipment?
Yes.
Aye.
Yeah.
And when we get into writing 2021's budget, we need to work out potential funding as a business case for the line item budget for at least 10 sets, or I'm sorry, 5 sets, possibly 10 sets. So that should be just a separate line item, or however we want to show that as far as recruiting volunteers. If they don't have to be in the academy until February, I know it takes time to order and supply it, but.
Yeah, we can work on that.
Reasonable. Yep.
And then maybe one of our grants comes through. Okay.
We also have to start thinking about that tanker replacement as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. That needs to go in the grant cycle too. And so in the budget cycle too.
Okay, so we're good with getting rid of the 2001-2003 bunker gear.
Yes. I would say definitely from the equipment locker for trainees that we currently have who aren't in academy or doing firefighting, I could take a view on that. Because as Charlie says, it's a bit odd if you just take all their equipment away. I can be swayed.
But I think if, you know, an example is Jay Hill has an old coat and an old set of pants. I wouldn't take it away from him. He cannot fight a structure fire. I don't know that he has that level of training. But, you know, anybody that is left with old gear, just because we can't afford to replace their gear right now, we shouldn't pull that away from them because it still has some reflective value for directing traffic and things like that. So,
yeah. That was the wordier version of what I was trying to say. Okay.
Jay Hill's pants are actually within date, Patrick. I think they're your old ones that were made in 2012. I think it's just his coat. And then I don't know whose gear is in the unknown locker. I don't think that person, if they're a new recruit, they definitely haven't been to Fire Academy yet. Yeah. And I think it goes without saying we're not sending Bill into a structure fire.
Yeah.
No. Okay. So we're clear on that. That makes sense to everybody.
To me, it does, yes.
Okay. Charlie, are you following that, Ryan?
Yes, I'm following that.
Good, okay. And it was station repairs and maintenance. I assume we have no problems with that continuing just as an ongoing things that have to be done.
No problem on my end.
Is there anything outstanding as far as station repairs or maintenance that we should be aware of, could be upcoming, before the end of the year? Anything that would be significant?
Not that I'm aware of, unless we back something into a door. Not that we've ever done that. But I don't think there's anything outstanding maintenance-wise. If you guys have
This is Ryan. I can't think of anything.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, not station maintenance wise. I'm sure vehicle wise, but not station maintenance wise.
Yeah. Okay. Good. But obviously, if things come up, let us know. There is, as far as I'm aware, there is still maintenance budget available for stations. So, if anything comes up, let me know. And then the last one in this section was radio reprogramming, which I don't have an issue with. I had a one of the 800 radios the other day that was, I don't think, is programmed properly. It didn't seem to have any of the right things in the right places, or that might just be me. But I know that Dan was working on that with Boulder County Sheriff's Office, or Boulder County Communications at least. So yeah, we should continue to do that to bring us up to date.
Scott Whitehead.
Right. Any objections to that program, that process continuing?
Nope.
Okay. Not me.
Good. So those are the pretty easy ones. Those are the continuing projects that we've been working on. In addition to those, there's a couple of training opportunities that have been worked on. We just need to make sure that we're okay with. So the first thing is getting our officers through a driver operator course. Timberline are organizing one, or have been organizing one, and talking to us about joining. Charlie's been, I think Charlie and Ryan have been talking to them about that. Was there any cost associated with that, guys? I'm not sure.
This is Ryan. It'll probably be very cheap. I believe taking the written tests might cost $30 a piece.
Right.
And the practical test, we'll have to chip in something towards the proctors.
Okay.
But it'd be pretty negligible considering they're getting six proctors together on one day. So it should be shorter and faster. But I don't really have a number.
Okay. That doesn't sound too out of line to me for the potential return. I'd like to see us have qualified driver operators. It's one of my big things. So unless there's any objections to that, I would suggest we continue to do that. And I think that happens this month.
Sure. That's good.
And one of the clarifications that Charlie and I talked about is this kind of effort to kind of get the officer corps through it, get some of the materials, and then roll it out to membership in the spring once kind of we know what all it entails.
Yeah, it also brings value back to us, which is even better.
Doesn't our insurance company still offer that class?
It offers a driver course, like an EVOC course, but it's not a full state-sanctioned driver operator course.
Yeah, this is pump theoretics, friction loss calculations, all your DOT, daily inspections. It's a full state certification class, I believe. Is that correct, guys?
Patrick, it's driver operator utility.
Oh, it's for utility. Okay, well, you got to have utility before first. You can get proper. What's that?
You have to do utility first.
Yeah. So this is required cert before you actually get your driver operator pumper through the state. So they got to go get this one first.
That is correct.
Yep.
Okay. I didn't hear any issues with that. I think it's something you should already have, and it's going to bring value back. So let's keep doing that unless anybody has an objection.
No.
Not I. No.
Okay. And then the second one was getting a scheduled live burn date. There's been some moving around of that because of people's schedules, but we definitely need to do that. We have not spent enough time in the burn building, and I believe the recent AAR also covered that quite heavily, that people felt that they hadn't had enough time in a burn building, and felt that they needed more training. So,
what are the costs to use the Boulder County facility?
So, Ian, we moved some stuff around, and I think Ryan's still working on it, but I think tentatively we have a schedule for October 6th. October 26th. So we're moving our auto extrication stuff that was supposed to be happening that week to the week of the driver operator. And I asked Craig Talbot if he or someone and do the class for us on that Saturday morning while we're doing the DO stuff. He hasn't agreed yet. He says he's going to get back to me. So that's kind of.
What is the cost to get down to the tower? And part of that, are you going to have some sort of crew or calendar signed up for riding positions on whichever engine you take down there, and then also schedule some sort of coverage, possibly if you've got the tower for the full day, maybe a 4-hour rotation and rotate crews down there? How are you planning on covering the district?
In the past, we've asked for Sugarloaf to help cover us, but since we don't have a date yet, we're not solid on the date yet. As soon as we have that, then I can do all of those things you just recommended.
Okay. And my next question is to get ALS coverage up here, does AMR, will they come up and cover, or do they charge us to stand by? What's the contract or the county contract with AMR?
Well, generally, if you're requesting coverage, you pay for it. Yeah. I mean, we can maybe talk a handshake deal with those guys, but it's a for-profit agency, so I don't think there's any handouts being given. But we can have that conversation with them, at least since we house them in the wintertime, when they're up here for ski season.
It would be nice to get some sort of dialogue there, just so that, if Ryan, you're the on-duty ALS provider and you're going down to go to required necessary training, we don't go without ALS coverage of some sort. So could you just look into that and see what they would be willing to do to help us out?
Take care of it tomorrow.
Okay. And we may have some... may have some other options there as well that we can discuss. Volunteer paramedics who work with us, and maybe a per diem as well, which I've been looking at.
Well, we might be able to get George up here for the day since he's not an active firefighter.
Yeah. However it gets done, I just don't want to send, all the volunteers down the hill and not have ALS and not have at least, obviously Sugarloaf would cover, but have a few up here that know the district. And also, if you use George, that's fine, but to help George out too, so he does have some folks helping him, working with him.
Absolutely. I think all that goes without saying.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so let's keep working on getting that scheduled then.
And I have a quick question, if I could jump in here, Ian. And this is for my own edification in regards to how the shift officers define the responsibility. So, say, for instance, each of these projects that are going on, is there a particular individual that's directly responsible for the focal point for getting this, moving this project along and taking inputs from others and so on and so forth? Or, is it you know, like one day it's Ryan, one day it's Charlie, one day, you know, Dan, one day, you know, well, how do you guys do this? Is it like for the shift off or for the driver operator course, is there somebody, a focal point that everybody's working through and that person is doing the organizing and getting everything set up?
Todd, for we broke it up. So Ryan's handling quartermaster and the structure fire side of things.
Okay.
Definitely doing wildland. I'm handling fleet management and I'm doing all the training stuff. Dan is handling EMS and EMS certifications and ordering and that sort of thing. So we are kind of there's fleet manager. Yeah, there you go. So that's kind of how we're divvying up the tasks. And then if somebody needs a hand with this, then we're just helping fill in.
Okay. And thanks for bringing that up, Ian. I see, I remember that document now. Thanks.
That's good. There's been a lot of document flow recently. Okay, so unless there are any objections, the direction to the offices is to continue scheduling the live burn and the DO courses then.
I don't object.
Okay.
No objection here.
So a couple of projects that have come to light, one of which is a bit of a touchy subject. Didn't really have a narcotics handling policy, which is takes us out of being compliant. So there's been some work towards creating that policy. I believe it's still a work in progress. But there's also been some changes to the way the narcotics are stored within the building. I don't want to go into too many details because obviously this is a public meeting. I believe it's incredibly important that we continue rectifying the problems that we've found and so that we realign ourselves with the DEA policies that we should be following. There's a couple of things that are probably going to come out of there, which is that we should have a safe in the building. And as far as the handling of the narcotics between the shifts, that's been worked on and the shift officers are implementing that policy now, I think it'd be safe to say. But obviously, I don't think that's a questionable activity. I think that just has to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Go. Okay. Managing out of district training, I think that was, we pretty much covered that. Charlie, did we miss anything in out of district training? Just got your name attached to it.
Oh, that Alex was looking at taking a 215 class. I think as far as I know, that's the only other out of district besides the driver operator. Ian, if we could just bounce back to the NARC stuff.
Yeah.
The costs involved with that. And I know it's a public meeting, but there's definitely going to be some costs involved with that.
Yeah.
And so, you guys should just be prepared. I mean, my guess off the hip would say in the $1,000 range.
Okay.
But I can tell you that other agencies around are spending a lot more than that a year to handle their NARCs.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the quote I got with what Boulder Rural is now doing is it's costing them 35, I think they said 3,500 a year or 3,000 a year.
What are they spending that on exactly?
It sounds like they have a computerized system that's giving them barcodes. And so it's like scanning the barcodes. And it kind of sort of sounded like a Pixis kind of thing. But I just saw the, you know, the dollar sign, and they said they would get me all the information once they're done with all their policies. But they weren't at the time of our last discussion, which was only like, you know, maybe 5 days ago.
Sure. And you put $1,000 estimate to bringing us up to compliance, or what is that $1,000 for?
So, I mean, what recommended to me is that, you know, we have, the backup NARCs have to be double locked, or essentially through two locked doors. And so we would need to lock some type of closet or room or something like that. And then we would have to have a safe, most likely bolted to a floor somewhere, unless it was something really big, which isn't really necessary. So we have to have the money for that safe. But the other thing that was highly suggested or recommended was that we have a camera on that. And so I haven't had the time yet to dig really deep into that, but you know, whether or not we have it's a motion activated or it's always on, that I think is going to be the trick. So
is Boulder Rural doing something similar to that, or any idea how they're addressing these issues?
I actually got that information through the former manager of AMR, who's now acting as the pre-hospital coordinator at Boulder Community. I don't have that. The information I got was via email from Boulder Rural. So I could follow up that information.
So since you've got the drugs inventory now, how often are you going to be counting that inventory or checking that inventory? Is that a monthly basis?
We've always been counting them. We go through inventory every shift.
So every shift you do, okay.
But both paramedics, one coming, you know, one leaving and one coming on duty, they sign off and agree that the count is there. And then we're other measures with some lockout security tags as well, to help maintain all that security.
Excellent.
Okay, so
are we
all good with that?
Looking to continue with this, or?
Yes, would be my answer. And then once we get the costs for just bringing ourselves into compliance, we can deal with that at that point.
Yep.
Or just safe, or you talking?
It doesn't have to be big. I mean, just the size of a couple tackle boxes, like fishing hook boxes, you know, not gigantic. It's not like we're keeping that many narcotics in the building. So, but it needs to be secure. It needs to be a real safe. And we need to figure out if there's going to be something that can be programmed with several different codes, because there's all kinds of concerns. Multiple people have the same code, but then there's a different concern when only one person has the code. So then what do you do when you need the backstock and that person's not on duty? So we have to, we're still working on that part of the policy.
Well, I guess, figure out what kind of safe you need and get a price estimate and what it's going to take to bolt it or secure it and follow through with whatever the DEA is saying needs to be done or best practice according to, you know, Boulder Community or Boulder Rural, give us an estimate as what it's going to cost, so we can certainly make sure we're compliant and using best practice with securing narcotics.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think in the short time that I've been working on this, we've made a lot of giant leaps. So I think we've already moved into the right direction. I think we have one more big step that we need to take care of, and then we'll be pretty dialed. I mean, currently, the way it's working right now, currently, I believe we're compliant, but it makes it kind of tricky, and there's a couple little issues with it that I don't want to really bring up in public.
Yeah.
Okay, I would definitely suggest that we continue resolving those issues. Obviously, if it turns into a $25,000 safe, I may take that back. But from what you're saying, it doesn't sound like that's the direction you're headed. So that's good.
No, it's not.
Okay, so if we're done with that, I'm going to come back to the out-of-district training because I think I've got another question about that further down that came in today. Changes to our COVID-19 policy. This is a request from the membership for a little bit of clarification about the COVID-19 policy in the building regarding visitors. And when we're working together in spaces that are less than socially distant. So, Charlie today took our current COVID-19 policy and updated it. I can just quickly run through this. So, basically, no visitors, tours, or non-critical entry shall be granted to our firehouses during the pandemic. A lot of this is already in the old policy. Charlie, you can tell me when I cross over into the newer items. Lifting of this policy will be discussed and reevaluated and ultimately adjusted once public health recommendations have changed. If non-members or non-employees require access, we insist on them wearing some form of mask or covering. NFPD will provide a mask if they do not have one. Remember to answer the doors of our station with a mask on. Insist the proper social distancing, when speaking with visitors at the entryways. Minimize the time and exposure as much as possible during their visit. Which pretty much brings us into the same as if you're going to a store.
Yeah, really. Or as we're okay.
Say that again, I talked over you.
I said number four is really what I added today.
Okay. I'll get there. I'll just rush there then. So then masks will be worn by all members in public when representing the department and responding to calls. Masks will not be required in single occupancy vehicles, but have one available on arrival. And all of our vehicles are now stocked with masks as far as I'm aware. For suspected COVID medical calls, please follow our COVID response guide, 325/2020, which was emailed to you. Charlie, I'd missed that. That should probably be attached to this policy as well when you file it. For all non-COVID suspected calls, please make sure all responders are in surgical masks and that patients and other parties unable to maintain social distancing are masked as well. Please provide a surgical mask to anybody else who needs one on scene. In the event of a wildland fire, search and rescue or other similar operations where physical distancing can be maintained and interaction with the public is not anticipated, masks may be kept at the ready but are not required to be worn. All of that seems fair to me. If you are symptomatic, please stay at home and away from calls. Advise the department and let us know if you need any support. Symptoms can include fever, cough, aches, difficulty breathing, and flu-like symptoms. You may return 72 hours after all the symptoms have subsided, and it has been at least 7 days since the symptoms started. This policy will be updated if testing guidelines change this standard. And then, as Charlie said, number four, the one that I think we added today. So in trainings, if trainings are in the classroom, then all participants will have their temperatures checked at the beginning of class. If anyone's temp is greater than 100.0, then that participant needs to leave the station and not return until it has returned to normal. Participants and instructors will also be required to wear masks for the entire length of the training. If possible, the class will try to maintain 6 foot spacing or try to limit only one student per table. If trainings are outdoors or in the bay, the six foot distance is unobtainable, then all participants must wear masks. Seems fairly sensible to me, as we're probably about to enter the rebound of COVID, sadly. Any comments or questions?
Seems very reasonable and wise.
So we already have a COVID response guide, which is basically gowns, masks, and I think face shield or eyewear, Charlie, correct me on that, if you want to call that.
Yeah, it's...
there's a potential COVID.
It's mask, goggles, gown, gloves.
Right. Any other questions?
That seems fine to me too.
Yeah. Okay, as this is a policy, I'm going to make a motion that the board adopts the changes to the COVID-19 policy. Can I get a second?
So moved.
I'll second.
Everybody seconded it, so I'll go with.
Yeah.
Everybody agreed. Cool. Okay, thank you.
Hey, Charlie or Ryan, we still need some sort of policy sign off or acknowledgement for all members. So we need to work out some tracking system or method to make sure that as we approve or update policies that either the assigned company officer goes over that with your individual members or however that happens. So would you guys put some thought into that and figure out how we can make sure that this information is disseminated down to even our newest members, please?
Okay. Yeah, we can figure something out.
Yeah, I think it's like a Google Doc, it'd probably be fine. We can make that work. So, okay. Moving on, so purchasing is an issue. This came up at least twice this week, the last week. So we just need some clarification from the board on how the shift officers can go about purchasing things that they need for operational needs. So couple of things that I just put in here. Medical supply orders, large and small, they're generally less than $1,000, as far as I understand, and mostly can wait for authorization. But my question would be, do we just want to authorize medical supply orders? I don't think anybody's going to be going out ordering thousands of dollars of stuff. We will get the benefit of being able to do this without having to come all the way through the board.
Yeah, how often do these orders have to take place? Is it a couple this week, maybe?
I would be surprised if we did more than two in a month.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And you're thinking like maybe. And that total in a month is less than 1,000, or each order is somewhere less than 1,000?
I would be very, very surprised if we spent more than $1,000 in a month.
Okay.
Are you, now that you've gone through your EMS cash. What are your deficiencies? Do you have any?
I actually
do. You have anything?
That's Dan. He just finished it this last rotation, so I haven't really had any time to absorb anything. It didn't seem like there was a lot of supplies needed on the board, so I think overall it looked like we're in pretty good shape. But I don't want to put words in Dan's mouth if he's been here.
One other question. Historically, we have been spending this every month, you know, for some time now, right? This is kind of a common order that goes out during a month. Is that correct?
Yeah, we haven't bought anything new or out of the ordinary, if that's what you're asking.
Well, I mean, like last month we may have spent some, you know, something under $1,000. The month before we spent something under $1,000. The month before, in other words, this is just has been happening, where we've been placing these medical supply orders monthly, and typically it's not exceeding $1,000 a month. Is that a true statement?
Yes. The only thing that I could say that may be coming due are the new packs that we've been working on, the new supply bags that we've been working on.
Mm-hmm.
So I that coming due, but I didn't do any of those orders Dan did. So I don't really have any real information on those for you.
Well, Ian, are you implying that maybe we just set a limit of $1,000, and if it would happen to go over $1,000, then they notify us, but they just keep us informed of what was spent?
Under $1,000, no issues. If it goes over $1,000, then we need to talk about it. This is just operational orders. So the med bags thing we'll talk about is,
yeah.
Although we'd already agreed to that project, we still need to know how much that will cost. So,
our normal expenditures are disposables, correct?
Yes. Pretty much. Sorry, say again.
What's the budget reflect?
The budget reflects. So the budget amount was $6,000. We are currently running 8277, but I think a chunk of that was probably COVID supplies. Without going back in detail to look at that, I can't tell from here.
We have spent a lot of money on COVID supplies, so gowns and goggles and gloves. Yeah. And I think Dan came out with an email this week saying that gloves are going up at least $4 a box, and we'll continue to rise. And so
nope. We
ton of supplies. I think the only thing that we'll have to kind of keep reordering, I think, would be the gloves.
Yeah.
I think overall we're in pretty good shape with that stuff. And we've recently even had some donate some new masks to us. So we've been pretty fortunate.
Is there any reimbursement for COVID-related items? Is there? Have you guys looked into anything like that?
I think
Ryan did.
Yeah.
Is he still on? He's not. As Ray said, most of your purchases are disposable items. You're actually using them on calls, and they're required items to protect you or the patient, or medications that you've used on the patient. So I have no problem with replacing all your disposables and maintaining your inventory so you can actually do the job.
Yeah, and I think another part of that, Patrick, is, you know, if we can, you know, the goal to minimize the 7,200 different, you know, kits that we have, and you know, I think if we can kind of minimize some of that stuff, we'll decrease our disposables.
Right. So running, what are you averaging? Probably 30, 35 calls a month, somewhere around in there.
Sounds about right.
It sounds about right. We're at three. I think we got to 314 today.
Yeah. So,
but I mean, every call isn't going to require the same.
No.
And just to put that into context a little bit, our EMS budget is 65% for the year. So we're about roughly on target, even though the supply side of it is over because of the COVID supplies. So I don't see this being an issue, and we need to do something to make sure that we're operational.
I'm okay with it.
I as well.
Okay. So we'll set that at $1,000 limit and then otherwise come to the board. And then
that's a month. That's a monthly limit. Just one-time purchase limit.
Not a one-time purchase limit. Yeah, sorry, monthly limit. And then the other thing that came up was just purchasing the small items, office supplies, certification fees, batteries. Obviously, again, this is an operational need. So my suggestion on that is around $200 a week. And I don't think there's any need that would be exceeding that, unless anybody has any input on that.
I just want to make sure that whatever they're purchasing, are they doing a purchase order and identifying which account it should be credited to and attaching their receipts?
So two of those three things. I discussed this today with Charlie. I need to discuss it with the other shift officers. For anything that they're going to do in this purchasing, it requires a purchase order. With the either order or receipt attached. The account number part of it is more Kathy's realm.
But, okay.
As long as they explain what it's for, then she can do that. That's not a problem.
Ian, do you have a plan to write a purchase order, that a form that you want us to use, or where does that
work? It's in the policies and guidelines folder. It's attached to the purchasing policy.
Okay.
So what is the, can you explain again what the guidance is there? Is it $200 per week? And if it goes over $200 per week, is there anything that we need to put a limit on there, or how does that happen?
So it'd be cumulative across the week. Obviously, that's a random value. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. What we really need to spend, and this is really, again, it's stationary items, batteries, things like that. It's just quick mm-hmm. things that need to be done that can't wait for.
So I see a little problem with this, and maybe it's a simple, but between the three shift officers plus Hendrickson plus Harrison plus Bill, whether going to ACE, going to Business Connection, going to BNF, going to where, who is spending?
Yeah, I think that there should be somebody that's kind of the person who's keeping track of the monthly spend. Or weekly spend, or however, but somebody needs to purchase orders, who the purchase orders go through, so that they're tracking how much is being spent. I think that there needs to be a responsible party for that.
Yes.
So there's
our end of watch report, and we sort of tally it, except for, Bill doesn't do an end of watch. He doesn't do an end of watch.
Okay, so you guys are tallying it at the end of watch report, but who's watching each shift?
So let me ask a question. If you need office supplies, Jim would handle that, wouldn't he?
Yeah, except for Ryan, I guess, is Ryan became the gatekeeper for Staples, so I think he's doing some of the stuff with Staples.
I showed Jim how to do it as well, so okay. He can do it too.
So why don't we let Jim handle just office supplies, anything of that nature. You guys let him know what you need if you need something. And he would only try to limit our number of purchases, how often we're purchasing. So, you know, he can certainly hold off a few weeks if he can and then make one large purchase. And then let's identify someone for other station staples, from toilet paper to batteries, and figure out when you need it and just make one order, whether it's through Amazon or Ace or however you want to get it.
And also, as we're having weekly meetings, if this limit turns out to be wrong, we can always change this.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. I've been thinking that we're going to see this monthly, but we're actually going to see it weekly. So I guess that's a good point.
Right, sir. Yeah.
I think just the ACE side of things might be a little trickier, just because, you know, whenever we're doing projects, light bulbs are out on trucks, and you know, whatever. Yeah. That gets a little greasier.
So do you think it should be higher? Or is it more the process?
I think the ACE side of things, you know, with all the little things that we buy from ACE, whether it's nuts and bolts or, you know, whatever it is on the maintenance side, I think that kind of needs to remain as kind of an open, more of an open account, not wait until the stuff piles up, because we use ACE a lot.
Yeah.
Is that just a walk-in purchase and essentially a verbal charge? And we get a bill?
Yeah, we have an account with ACE.
How much tracking is done on that?
I have no idea. I've never seen it. Seen the bill.
I don't think the bill tracks to detail, but the ones that I've seen, at least.
Well, when you make a purchase at ACE, you should get a printed receipt as well that gets turned into Kathy.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so she must run them against each other then, so it is tracked then.
Is some sort of statement written on the receipt saying where this is going?
So they used to, what we used to do, Ray, is we would sign our name and then put 5601 next to it, or station one or something like that. And they changed something where it no longer mattered. So they no longer got a copy of the receipt on our statement. So I don't know how that has all changed. I just know that we don't do that anymore.
Well, then that creates a tracking problem for us, which is vehicle maintenance, which is station maintenance, such as other things.
I'm not.
It's been this way for 11 years. I've never written any guidance on any receipt, and I was never asked to.
So regardless of whatever we decide on tonight, this is something that we need to fix.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so our ACE purchases can be way over 200 a month.
Yeah.
Well, but I don't think we have any big projects going on right now. So I don't see anything being too huge. And if you kind of write it as a guideline, you know, that might be the only way. Because some months we spend zero, some months we might spend 300. But, you know, to bump along.
I get that. I get that totally. But that's hard for us to plug into the budget.
Yep, but we've never been instructed to do. You know, I mean,
we're going down a new road where we are going to start looking at that kind of stuff.
I have no problems with it. You just tell us how you want it handled.
Well, it's something that we got to work towards.
Well,
yeah. I got a question for you.
I'd prefer that we hold off on using the account at ACE and just use your purchase card so we know exactly what was purchased for how much and where that item went. So if it went to 5601, it was a light bulb. We know that it's 5601 and the turn signal light.
I don't think we have, unless I'm the only one that didn't get it, I don't believe we have any purchase cards yet.
I haven't seen one. And the other thing, the issue with that is, I don't think ACE would be set up to do individual purchases like that and take off the taxes.
Tax exempt part.
Yeah. Mm. So just looking sort of a year to date, the ACE bill runs about $600 a month.
Well, it's not something we're going to be able to fix tonight. So,
yeah.
We just, everybody has to be cautious and aware.
And then look to improve it next year. Yeah.
So my question was, when you do purchase at ACE, do they tend to be like, 25 cents or $25 or a mixture of in-betweens?
Yeah, because I mean, if I think I hit ACE more than anybody because it's just, I don't know what's happened, but you know, whether, you know, we're working on something that we need a drill bit or we need a wrench or we need 10 screws, you know, pull a wire, you know, it really depends on the project, but when you need
something, you have to do it right. So I get it.
Yep. So, yeah, Ian, I mean, it's, I don't know that I've ever really spent more than $50 there.
Right.
In a one-day purchase.
Yeah. But, I mean, keep in mind, Ray, that I've, you know, built entire fire trucks.
Yeah, I mean, I get it, Charlie.
It just depends on the project.
Absolutely.
Any big projects you're having in the near future?
No, I currently don't. I think the projects that we're working on right now, as far as cleaning stuff up, getting rid of stuff, and trying to get the trucks running and out the door, I think that's the big projects that we have.
And the trucks, is there any maintenance due on these trucks after being down to Keter Truck and back? Is there anything that you see on the horizon the next month that can't wait?
That can't wait, no. Rick, I guess, did all that work on 5601 and it's leaking again. And it seems like it's probably either a tank refill or a tank to pump that's leaking.
Okay. I don't think we're going to get the Akron valves from ACE Hardware for the tank to pump on that rig.
Yeah, I mean, that's a different conversation, I think. This is more of a just like disposable, small income budget.
No.
Just so you're you have the authorization to go and buy stuff that you need. It's not a, you know,
items. Because if the project's coming up, and that was the one that has kind of come to mind.
Yeah.
As we get into colder weather, we're going to have to drain that pump, and if the tank to pump is leaking or the tank refill, we're not going to be able to drain the pump.
Yep. Well, I'm okay with incidental things and not to exceed $200 in a month. But as someone said, tracking it so that not each one of you is spending $200, but I'm thinking collectively. And then Jim tracks all of his administrative stuff on his own.
Okay. So I think my suggestion was about 200 a week, but.
Sorry.
I mean, I don't think we really spend that much. Once we've got stuff, we don't really do that much. So, literally, this is just so that people can go and get the stuff they need to do their job during the day. So.
Your suggestion was 500 per week, right, Ian? And that includes ACE plus office supplies and everything.
If you made it 400 a week and included ACE, then it would be clear on the months.
Yeah.
I think that would probably cover us. Unless anybody's got any objections to that.
Good for me.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah.
All right. Just keeps us running. Disposal of items from the station cleanups we covered. This is a thorny one. It's been burning my day. Deployment policy. Rick Henriksen went on deployment, or is going on deployment potentially this week. Now, he has always had an agreement with the chief that he could go on deployment. So it didn't seem right to not let him go. But Ryan has come and spoken to me about doing deployments too. Obviously, at the moment, we are light in our paramedic department. And not having some kind of policy about this is creating some issues in the department, and not just from a full-time staff perspective. I think we have 5 volunteers out on deployment at the moment. It's been a really busy year. I'd never want them to stop them going away and making money. But I think we need to think about how we manage deployments a little bit. And certainly from the staff perspective, I think it's incredibly valuable for our staff to go out on deployment. They bring back a lot of experience that they just don't get here because I don't want to go there. I'm not going to say that.
I was just going to suggest, what's your aim? Are you aiming to try to define the next steps to creating a deployment policy in this meeting?
I'd kind of like to know where everybody sits, and I appreciate for you, Todd, this is probably a bit more alien. So there's been talk about sending one of our vehicles out, and the point about deployments, and anybody else can chime in here because I could be completely off base, is that generally speaking, the deployment pays for the backfill of the person that goes. Depends on the deployment, but I think that's generally how we've tried to run that. So we need to have a way to ensure that if someone is going away, they get backfilled, and it's an equitable arrangement. So it's not always one person who's going away. And it doesn't impact our other shift officers in a negative way. So
The reason I asked the question is because it seems like, you know, the shift officers, the permanent staff, you know, who, you know, presently has responsibility to making sure we have coverage, it seems like they should put together a deployment policy and then present it to us with a justification for why the policy says what it says, you know. In other words, maybe that's the best way to make sure that we have coverage and nobody feels like they're being kind of left out in the cold, you know, if the staff is doing it together and putting that policy together and presenting it to the board for approval. Am I way off base?
I would like to see that too, but I would also like to see a number of the volunteers that participate in deployment assist in drafting that policy, so it covers not only the paid staff, but the volunteers also. So we don't, you know, we have very few active responders, and if half of them are gone on deployment all at once, it really kind of leaves us pretty short. So I'd like for the volunteers to also be included in drafting that policy.
Excuse me, I was sneezing. Yeah, I mean, I think that's fine. Any comments, Ryan, Charlie?
No, we'll just have to work on drafting another policy.
Oh. Right. So we can't, our first priority is to the district, not to, you know, go to California. And I understand the benefit. I reap that benefit firsthand. But our primary employment, your primary employment, is with Nederland Fire Department, and that's who we have to take care of first. And that's why I want to make it perfectly clear, you know, how many paid members can go out at once. And that, you know, I would suggest that even a part-time member is still paid when that part-time member does cover periodically vacation and when our full-time guys are absent. So I think we have to be pretty careful with how many resources we send out of district. There are bigger departments that only send 4 people out of district. And I don't know that you know, we have the depth to continue to send, you know, 4 volunteers at a time and then maybe 1 part-time person or a full-time person. So we should make it fair and equitable and make it so that people can go out and yet at the same time still cover calls and not overtax the members that didn't go out. So with anything, you know, part of the problem is we started doing something, deploying members, before we actually had a written policy. That's a problem. Anytime you have a program, why don't we have a written policy on how we're going to conduct ourselves and conduct business?
Yeah, I think that's necessary. So, for this to work.
I'm sorry, it's another policy, but that's the way it's got to be. We just can't freelance and run off and disappear whenever we want to. I certainly can't do that here.
No, I think the struggle that I know that me and Dan have is just that, you know, we have so many people out and that people continue to want to go out on deployment. And you know, I think that for us, that's, you know, puts us in a hard spot because we don't want to deny anybody the experience or the pay. But, you know, honestly, for at least, I know I can't speak for Dan, but I mean, for me, it feels pretty shitty, especially in the time that we have right now. So I'm kind of in a way kind of uncomfortable and trying to produce this policy because, you know, I feel like I might be biased because I do feel a responsibility to the district and I don't want to prevent, you know, other responders from that, especially volunteers.
And that's why I think that we should have the volunteers that actually deploy. They can certainly, we have to set parameters. We have to be able to say, you know, we can't have, you know, five of our top eight responders out of district. So is there a calendar that we can develop and you sign up and, you know, you go available between these dates and we have no more than three volunteers and no more than one paid member at a time? However you guys make it look, but my point is that we can't leave the district uncovered.
No, I mean, I absolutely agree. I think the way, it, maybe I just took it wrong, but when you say, you know, you can't send your five top responders out, I mean, in a way you're, it sounds like you're almost penalizing the top responders for being, you know, top responders.
I'm saying send them all out at once. They should go out. I believe in the program. I think it needs to happen. It's something we can't pay for. You can pay for training. You can never pay for experience. And that's what they're gaining on this. So I understand the importance. I believe in doing this, but we have to do it intelligently.
Some sort of rotational system?
Yeah, that or like I said, I'd like to see the, you know, the volunteers certainly have their chance for input, because it does create a lot of income for some of the volunteers too, along with the experience. So I really think that they should have a big hand in helping drive the direction of this. But the one thing I don't want to see is just a free for all and turn around and you know, half our volunteers are gone and one or two paid guys are gone and we haven't thought this through all the way and now we're begging and pleading people to work overtime.
I just don't think that trying to limit the volunteers is going to fly real well. It's, you know, and we'll see, we'll include them in the process and see what comes up with it. But I know for Eric, not necessarily speaking on his behalf, this is his income. And I think for Chadikoff, to a certain extent.
That's why I want him to have input.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying, like, we'll have to include him once he ever gets back here.
Yeah. And, you know, we've also spoken about this previously about, do we want to put together our own team with a vehicle that does this? So it's an ongoing conversation that's never really gone anywhere. I'd like to see it go somewhere. I agree with Patrick. I think that getting people out of deployment is a really valuable experience that you can't get here. And obviously I truly appreciate that for some people it is their income. And I would hope that gets easier if we can, when we get more new people up to speed. But obviously that's not this year, because even just onboarding them is going to take us 2 or 3 months to sort through them. So, I think some kind of policy is definitely required. You know, I'm a policy kind of guy. So, have a think about it, and I appreciate the awkwardness of drafting this policy, and I'm quite happy to help draft this one and set that direction. I don't have an issue with that. Okay. Any further comments on that? Okay, well, if the shift officers can think about what that might look like and present that back to the board, and then we can see where that goes. Okay, so we have already previously discussed new volunteers, and we've been talking to some of the people who have either A, been trying to be a volunteer at Netfire for the last 6 months with very little success, or I think like four people who've knocked on the door and said, hey, how do I be a volunteer in the last month? Which shows that there's a lot of interest out there. And I think that we're losing a huge amount of resource by not doing something with those people. And this was a discussion that may be contentious and maybe not. It's a discussion that we had with the shift officers, that's Patrick and I, about how we could move them through the system faster, because waiting for 6 months is a definite disincentive. And at the moment, I don't believe we can afford to do that. We just don't have enough people. And realistically, we probably have, correct me if I'm wrong, 8 volunteers that are regularly turning up when they're not deployed. And that's just not enough for us to cover what we do in any way that makes sense. So I believe the number that's been floated is that there are 10 interested people. And the suggestion was, that rather than mess them around, we background check them, driver's license check them, and then for a couple of months at least, which A, buys us some time to look at budgets and gear. We have them come to training, which also means that we get to know them. And they get to know what they're getting into. Certainly in my experience, I've noticed that there's been a lot of people who've gone through the 6 months, turned up at 2 trainings, and then you never see them again. And that seems like an awful lot of effort on everybody's part. I'd rather see them walk in the door, go, okay, this isn't for me, and we can get through that quicker. Anybody else got any suggestions on that?
So I tend to agree with everything you said.
Yeah, can I ask what the difference is? Are you just eliminating the psych eval? Or what's being fast tracked? Or how is it being fast tracked?
Just getting them through into the system quicker. So you can be kind of hanging around for 6 months before you get in the door. And like I said, that's just disincentivizing. And I know we discussed in the previous board meeting, you know, onboarding twice a year. But if we have 10 people that are willing to turn up now. Then I think we can make that work. I agree that the one person onboarding at a time is probably not the way to go. But I just think it's been interesting in the last month or so that we've managed to get to 10 people. And I think it would be great to have a new intake and start getting them on board in training and figuring out what they can do and what they want to do. I think one of the other suggestions was that, you know, not all volunteers want to be firefighters. Some of them may just want to do EMS. Some of them may only want to do firefighting. Some of them may just want to be wildland. And it'd be interesting to see how that plays as to where people fall. One of the other suggestions that was mentioned to me by one of the members was, you know, some of these people might be bringing in business skills or other skills that could be of great use to the department that we don't really necessarily investigate. So it'd be interesting to see how we can talk to people and understand what their skills are. I think there's been a unwillingness to do that in the past. And part of that is that you don't want to overburden the volunteers. Then to a degree, if they've got a skill that's of use to you, then maybe that's how they're going to, that's how they're going to sort of like, you know, pay back the department, or that's how their volunteership is going to work. So what I'm looking for here is just some clarity from the board as to whether the process of onboarding people and getting them to come to training so we get to know them seems like a good way to, good direction to go in, both for them and for us.
I'm in agreement with that. Got to keep them going through the pipeline until they flush out or not.
Yeah. I mean, we've no idea what the dropout rate will be. I know that on intakes, we've seen anywhere between 0% to 100%. And that's also something that we need to track and understand why. Whether mm-hmm. that's them or us. Any further comments, Ray?
It's not a new problem. I mean, it's plagued us forever.
As in the lack of volunteers?
No, they come.
Yeah.
It seems like they come, they get some training, and another opportunity opens up. I mean, we've been a stepping stone into paid service for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
We put quite an investment in them.
Yeah. I don't think I necessarily have a great issue with that. I accept that that's a thing. But having people hanging around for 6 months, you live two blocks away from the fire station, just seems a not sustainable, it's not, well, it is an unsustainable policy.
What right now do we have as far as if we say that they need to have a clean driving record and a clean CBI report? Are we saying a clean driving record is absolutely nothing on their record, or a minor driving infraction needs to be explained, or any thoughts on that? Obviously, I think the clean Colorado Bureau of Investigation background report needs to be clean.
Yeah.
But what are we saying is the, you know, the deal breaker for DMV printout? Multiple speeding tickets, one speeding ticket? Is it, you know, so we need to be clear so that we're not adjusting that for each person that walks through the door. It has to be the same criteria for everyone.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, the obvious ones are DUIs or DWIs. I would be wary of somebody who had multiple speeding tickets. So, yeah, I see your comment there.
Would human resources be able to quantify that as far as I think the CBI report is pretty straightforward. You should not have a criminal background. But where we can certainly get into gray areas, okay, well, what's an acceptable driving record? And I suspect that human resources could certainly give us a good answer on what's acceptable and what's not. Also, our insurance company may say, we're not taking anybody with, you know, multiple speeding tickets or whatever, so we should maybe even check with our insurer. Is that Pinnacle? So there's two resources that might give us a definitive answer.
Yeah.
that takes away any subjectivity, and we don't have to worry about, you know, making that decision and not being fair across the board.
That makes sense.
But in theory, yes, I can agree with what needs to be done. And if we get five people that hang around out of the 10, I would call that a success.
I'd call that a win.
I'd like to see, if you guys decide to go that route, I'd like to see something written down as far as if we can tell people, because I can't tell you how many times people are like, well, I had a DUI 25 years ago, or I had a, you know, a drug charge 20 years ago, or, you know, something along those lines. It would be a lot easier for us when we meet people at the door. It's like, oh, well, what do you guys need? And what does it take?
Gotcha. Okay. I think we can work on that.
25 years ago isn't going to be on their current record.
Well, at least that's good. They're honest. If they're telling you that.
Right. But I mean, is that okay then? You know, I mean, that, you know, I guess that's what we have to figure out.
Yeah.
And the existing, is there anything in the existing personal guidelines about that?
No, there's not. The only thing that references it is in the application, where it's like, you know, it says if there is something that's going to show up in your driving record, please explain it here.
Yeah.
So that's still, that's actually subjective in and of itself. I think when we're dealing with, even though they're volunteer, technically they're filling out an application and we're either granting or denying them access to the organization. I think anytime we're being subjective and making decisions that could, you know, differ from person to person, case to case, we're not setting ourselves up to be in a very good position.
Mm-hmm. There's danger there. Okay.
So yeah, I think.
I think that's something we need to work on fairly rapidly. So, Patrick, can you have a think about that?
Yeah.
And talk to the HR people and just say, you know, what's reasonable.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Should we aim for an update on that next week? Just because I'm sensitive that we have people who are itching to join.
Yeah, I don't know if
I'll move that forward.
Don't know if I'll be able to provide you a policy, but I can certainly get you answers.
Yeah, let's start there. That sounds good. Okay. Unless there's any more comment on that process. Okay, so I received a letter to the board of directors, which I did forward to all of you, just regarding some clarifications, a couple of things that we haven't already covered. The waiver of vacation policy for this year. Yeah, I mean, that's only fair, I think, given the situation we're in. I appreciate you all modifying vacation plans and training plans to ensure that we have district coverage during this period. Probably means that we're going to have to figure out how you all take a load of vacation next year. I mean, horrible things. Anybody on the board have an issue with that?
I don't. I think it's commendable.
The only thing that could come back would be the liability.
Yeah.
Because we don't carry a line item that covers an absorbent amount of vacation time.
We carry a liability for vacation time year on year, but that's more for if you end employment.
We had some sort of discussion about this some time ago.
It was back in June. We never really resolved it, to be honest with you. I'm not going to say that. I don't think there's really a way out of this at this point. I would ask that the shift officers next year think about reducing their vacation. And that's what we spoke about in July. I know Charlie did a pretty excellent job doing that. He's worked very hard at that.
Well, I know this is... I can't think of the word right now, but it's definitely a change for them. Mm-hmm. But we also have to be careful that they don't get a whole bunch of crew and decide to take a whole month off on us.
Well, it's funny you say that, because that was going to be my next question.
No.
No, thank you. That's easy. So, I guess that maybe yes, but you can't have it all off in 1 month.
I guess that's the only heartburn I have.
Yeah. I understand that, and it's just the way this is working out, unfortunately.
No, Ian, it seems like some time ago, maybe a couple years ago or a year or so, or...
So there's...
ended up being quite a discussion about the vacation.
Okay. I know we had one in June. I think there was one a few years ago with the auditor, because the auditor makes us have a set aside for vacation.
Yeah, I think we were worried about... sick. Too much accrued time and not having the assets to meet it if someone walked in and said, hey, I want my vacation in cash.
Yes.
I ask you guys, why is it that we're not trying to fund per diem or part-time paramedics?
Well, that's something we need to look at. Current budget wouldn't do it.
Well, I think on the flip side, it's much cheaper than paying me or Ryan or Dan time and a half.
Well, overtime does hurt us. I mean,
yeah.
But I mean, it's just, you know, another tool in our toolbox. If we want to send people on deployment, if we want to take vacation days, if people are feeling like they're being overworked because you know, somebody is taking vacation or whatever the story is, you know, or if it's FMLA or whatever, we don't really have the resources right now to fund or, you know, we don't have any part-time. So I really think that.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you on that one though. We need a way of covering vacation time that doesn't push it back onto, you know, you guys who are already working your 96s, 48, sorry.
Charlie, I might have missed something. Did you have somebody in mind?
Well, Connor wants to come back part-time.
Oh, Connor. Okay. Yes, I heard that. I knew that.
He's a great asset to Medfire. I mean, he's a tremendous paramedic.
Yes, I don't disagree there.
And I think there's probably some other assets out there that we could talk to and see if they had some interest.
Well, when we start working on this new budget format, I guess that's where that discussion comes in.
Yeah. That's a conversation for another meeting. Because that's rapidly approaching too. I don't think this is a question that I could say no to. I think the shift officers are being very flexible for us.
I agree. I also agree with Ray and whomever brought up the idea, or Charlie, the having a cadre of part-time, qualified part-time personnel we could possibly pull from. And that's something we're obviously going to have much greater discussion on and here in the very near future for the next budget cycle. But I appreciate the guys putting off personal plans to maintain staffing here at the district. So I think, you know, any vacation that was scheduled and not used, then roll it over. But we also have to start planning a way to see that being used.
Yeah, I'll talk to Kathy and figure out what that looks like as well for next year. Because that wasn't necessarily part of the budget planning, I don't think. So. Any comment, Todd?
No, I think that sounds fine.
Okay, so I could go with the yes and then we'll try and take the same month off next year. We'll see how that works. Vehicle disposal is still ongoing in terms of that. So we actually had some interest in the old yellow engine the other week, whether that was just somebody who was passing and thought they might want it or not. We'll see if they come back to us. I wasn't aware that the old plow truck... Are we talking, so the old plow truck was up on the list of vehicles that were going. I don't remember that conversation.
I mean the old plow truck as in the red truck behind station two.
Ooh, that old plow truck. Sorry.
Yes.
There are so many.
The old military truck with the utility bed?
Yes.
I thought there was an interested buyer.
We do. We just have a titling issue with that one. So that's kind of, we're trying to figure that one out at the moment. Sorry, I misunderstood.
Well,
which vehicle we were talking about?
He was asking me about title, and I know that's military surplus.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that stuff never did have a title. When I got rid of that old ambulance, we had quite a bit of problems, and I ended up meeting the people that were buying it at DMV, but I don't remember what I had to prove that we owned it and it was untitled.
I mean, if you know for a fact that it's never been titled, Ray?
No, it was the Commerce City police thing that somehow we got our hands on, and it didn't have a title.
Okay.
Which I guess 23 doesn't have a title either.
There's not, but I think that one we can resolve.
That was state EMS grant. So that probably means that 20 doesn't have a title.
I've never seen a vehicle. I've never seen a vehicle of that generation in the 90s that don't actually have a title.
Well, but then were EMS grants from the state, so that the state probably retained title on them because there was agreements. Like we couldn't get rid of it in a certain time frame. I don't remember all of the stuff, but Jim couldn't find a title for the red Ford. So my guess is state still has that. I mean, you're right. There should be a title somewhere, but we just don't have it.
Okay. I think it's being worked on anyway. That's the main point. Hopefully that one will come to life at some point. We also had interest in the yellow truck. That was the same guy who wanted the yellow engine, but I don't think we've heard anything back on that yet. And we haven't officially done anything with any of these.
That came from Rocky Flats.
And then the old command vehicle, which I know the chief was interested in. Yeah, I mean, I don't really have any hard answers at this time. The titling issue that's come up has actually complicated things, and I think that's just slowed everything down. But they are all still on the list of things to move, if that's clarification enough. Okay, in addition to all that, there's a lot of things that have been found while cleaning up, I think. The two scavenger skid units from Station Tiako, hole 31. So are those basically like incomplete then? Is that what you're saying in here?
Yes, they were kind of pulled piece. We had one, we got another one, and so engine was taken off one, hose reel off another, so there are two incomplete ones that are just rotting behind the station.
Is there additional parts on them that we might use?
Probably not, because they were just different enough that, I mean, yes, theoretically, you could use a hose reel off of it in the next 20 years, or is it going to be any good in that time?
Mm-hmm. You got to remember what era I came from.
Yeah. I do. I mean, I think they're just going to sit there and rot for the next 10 years.
It's my
experience.
We should try to be good neighbors too, and I know that there's residents there on Ridge Road that certainly probably get tired of seeing the cars, the training cars that we cut up, and a lot of the equipment that is kind of rusting in the sunlight. So if we don't have an immediate use for something that's already been picked over by, you know, one department or one fire district that got rid of the equipment, and now we've picked it over, I think it's probably worth getting rid of then.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're still running a fire district, not a pick and pull junkyard.
I agree with that. Uh, I don't know if you want to see if any of our neighbors would like to have a look at them and take them, and if that doesn't work, dispose of them. Does that make sense to the board?
You mean neighboring fire districts?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think some of the stuff, you know, it's been sitting around for such a long time. You know, we want to see if somebody can use it. I mean, unless it costs us money, it's, I hate to throw stuff away, but, mm-hmm. you know, better just to get it off of our hands, you know, if we're never using this stuff. Yeah. Snowmobiles, never been tested or used. Why? Why do we still have them?
But I agree, kind of dovetailing off of, you know, almost the deployment idea of if we're going to have a program, then we need to have training and policy and, you know, procedure on how to use them. You know, if you're going to send two people into the backcountry and it's snowy enough that they need the snow machines, we should have guys and gals that are trained to operate those properly and something that, you know, you might not want to ride back 2 miles if you know the thing may not start when you want it to.
That's a very valid point.
Does anybody know which era those are from?
Well, I think since the tracks got put on the ATVs, they're better, more stable. I've heard people say that they'd never ride a snowmobile again after being on them.
Really? Yeah.
So. I know them came from the city of Boulder. I don't know.
So can we try to sell them?
Well, there's probably
there's
most likely some sort of market for them.
You'd think, yeah.
Okay.
I'm looking at the extrication equipment.
Right.
I don't know if there's some sort of market for them. I mean, does Indian Peaks have any extrication equipment?
I thought no, they don't.
The sets from 23.
This is that Lucas stuff, isn't it?
I'm sorry, Ray, say that again.
This is the Lucas stuff?
I don't know. The original, whatever was prior to the...
Yeah, it's just, it came in that same ESM. ESM. Shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
We got the ambulance, the truck, the defibrillator, and the extrication tools.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it's 92 version era, I believe. But it's still operational.
Yeah, maybe. But
someone could
maybe
use
it. Indian Peaks said yes. Indian Peaks might want it.
Yeah, you know, it's like I say, somebody could use it, I'm sure. I'm not even sure what high countries are not even, it's not high country anymore.
Timberline.
I had to step out. If you were talking about giving it to Timberline, Timberline already has newer and better stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, are we all okay, though, seeing if our neighbors would want the skid units, the snow machines, and the extrication equipment? If they don't want it, see if we can sell it?
I am. I think it's just going to lay around for another 10 years again.
I'm totally good with that.
Okay.
Ray, are you okay with going at it that way?
I mean, I want to see it get good use.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah, me too.
Equipment was just essentially taken out of service in the last
9 months, a year?
Sorry, Ray, what's been taken out of service the last 9 months?
The extrication equipment. They've got, is it been a year?
That stuff's from the, you know, 92. That's, we have a set in between.
This is the hydraulic unit that was on the back of 24.
Okay, that one. Yes, I thought we were talking about the one that you're talking about from 92.
Well, it came in 92 with that red truck.
We had a newer set than that.
Yeah, so there's a newer set on 24 that's also now redundant, really.
Replaced.
Okay.
Because that, well,
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, the new Hurst Kia we got, the EMS grant, is just far superior.
Well, if somebody nearby, isn't Indian Peak still getting the red truck?
Yes, we're working on that. That's a titling issue.
Well, it's worth the conversation with them.
Totally.
And if they don't have a need for it, can we just post it on State Fire Chief's page? I'm sure there's got to be a department out on the Eastern Plains that would love to have that equipment.
Yeah, some other rural department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, yes. I'd be for that.
Okay.
Before we haul up for scrap iron.
I can contact Indian Peaks. I already got a good contact with them through other means. And I also have a contact in Timberline just to check with them as well.
Okay. That sounds good. Uh, 5622, thorny subject. Can I take a, I would like to take a view on that for the moment. And the same as 5633, I'd rather see us work through a vehicle replacement plan or a vehicle retirement plan, as it probably is. Any other comments on that?
Ian, when you say 5622 vehicle replacement plan, you want to replace our third ambulance?
No. I don't think I do. I don't think we need three. I'm just kind of on the fence with it. That's all. If somebody has a compelling argument, I'm certainly willing to listen.
I mean, I can honestly say that I think the use of the gear from 22 in the red command truck is more useful than having 22 out in station 2.
Right.
The plot 2s.
When was the last time we went on a call?
You know, it's funny that you, I couldn't tell you the last time it went on a call, but after going through all the NARC stuff, Todd, we have provided narcotics to, I think it was 2 or 3 people in, I think it was 6 years.
Okay.
Out of that ambulance.
Which you're implying that it was on a call, basically, at that time.
Well, and so one thing that has happened is if maybe we're at station 2 and we get a medical call, then it would make sense to roll the ambulance that we're standing next to instead of roll the ambulance out of station 1. So
yeah,
happened.
So you could make an argument to have an ambulance at station 3 by that rationale, right?
Yeah, I mean, if that's the way you want to see that, sure. But, you know, if we have command 2, if we drive command 2 to station 2, which is fully equipped, you know, then we would provide the same care with that and then hopefully backfill with the ambulance out of station 1.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but this ambulance is also presided at station one when 21 is out of service.
Yep. There's no reason we can't run calls out of 20 when 21 is out of service.
Sorry, Ryan, my internet dropped out for a couple minutes. But yeah, I concur with what Charlie just said. You know, 20 is an adequate ambulance if 21's out of service. We've never run three calls at once, knock on wood, much less do we even have the staff available to do that today.
I guess this isn't quite a new conversation. I think I remember one meeting in March or somewhere around March where actually Beth at the time was calling in, and I think you guys had the conversation of the grant for new life packs, and she asked the question, why are we getting one for 22? And she was kind of, I only paraphrasing, but I think I remember her asking, you know, do we really need that ambulance? So I guess that's, we're back to that question.
Well, and I know, I'm assuming, Ian, you just posted that vehicle response.
Yeah, so these are the stats for it. I mean, it doesn't do anything. It's run.
No, it really does.
20 calls in 4 years.
So what I was going to say is that, you know, a lot of times our Ridge Road people might respond to a call in 22, but actually not provide any service with the vehicle. Mm-hmm. You know, they provide the same amount of service, which they're basically just using to transport themselves to a call emergently or non-emergently, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm. So they could do the same in 5632.
Yep. Yeah. And I don't think we DOT to that, so we don't know if there's some hidden hell in there too.
I mean, definitely needed. It's definitely got some major leak up front. We did an inspection from Terry, and I know that ambulance requires some work.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's just as far as equipment goes and maintenance goes, I think that thing's kind of a monster for us because, you know, we dump a ton of disposables or consumables or whatever you want to call it from that rig.
Yeah,
pretty much, you know, medications go there to die. They never get used. So we are just constantly just filling the trash with unused medication from there.
Would this be a reasonable compromise to, without getting out ahead of our skis, prepare that ambulance to go away and wait another month? Let's see what happens. But I don't see the need to keep a bunch of stock in that ambulance, material, supplies, medications that are just going to expire in there, and then we have to just buy new medication that's going to expire yet once again. Mm-hmm. But got it for now. And that may even potentially hold off on purchasing, you know, EMS supplies through the end of the month, just taking supply out of that ambulance.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's reasonable. I don't see, you know, we've taken all the kits out of it, so it's technically not in service now because they are now inside of Command 2.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's totally reasonable. And then, you know, Ian, if you were talking about vehicle replacement, I mean, 20. I could see being a replacement of some kind, you know, with something newer and safer.
Yeah.
Because as much as we've hard as we've tried, the brakes on that truck are still absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I take that. I mean, looking at the stats, it's really just an unfunded liability to me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
you know, if we had, no offense, Patrick, you know, if we had like paramedics up on Ridge Road who were running the ambulance two or three times a week, it'd be a different story, but it isn't really moving.
Yeah. And quite honestly, I got to tell you, when I was responding out of that station, I would just take the brush truck myself to go to a call,
right?
EMS call, or the engine, just because you don't need two ambulances on one EMS, or three ambulances after you get AMR up there on one scene. Mm-hmm. So, I struggle with the need for a piece of equipment, maintaining it, insuring it, and doing all that, stocking it, just to, quite honestly, I mean, we're kind of pouring our money down the drain doing that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. I mean, I'd go with getting rid of it.
I'd go with that too.
Bray, any opinion on that?
No, not really.
Okay, well, let's work towards that then. Destock it, decommission it. Okay, and then,
yep. Hey, I'm sorry to come full circle back to DMV printout and Colorado Bureau of Investigation. The CBI report is pretty straightforward. You can't have any felonies. Mm-hmm. But where I would push the DMV printout, I would encourage you guys to maybe look at the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, and they talk about driving offenses that would prevent you from getting your CDL. I realize we don't require a CDL, mm-hmm. but that would be a reasonably or a very good law that's in place that says, hey, if you have these driving infractions, you're not going to get a commercial driver's license. And we are operating trucks that do fit underneath what would be considered anybody else would have to have a CDL to operate these rigs. So yeah. If we use that as our baseline, I think that would be really difficult to challenge.
Yeah.
So if you wouldn't be eligible for a CDL, that might be a disqualifying criteria for your DMV printout.
Okay. We can have a look at that as a guideline. I think that makes sense to me.
Everybody comfortable with that?
Yes. Now, is that a third party to go to get that looked at?
No.
No, that's no, just it's regulations. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's through Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, and they set the law. And,
the Department of Transport.
Sorry. Exactly. And so I think that would certainly, it would take the subjectivity out of your DMV printout, and that would give everybody department-wide the understanding that, well, if I actually have an infraction that would make it so I couldn't theoretically acquire a CDL, I might not be able to drive these trucks, or it could jeopardize my membership here or employment.
Sounds reasonable to me.
Okay. we'll circle back up on that one, have a look at it. Last couple of things on here. We can rattle these out. Sorry, I appreciate it's getting late. The exhaust system at Station 2, it's been there 9 years. I think that's a valid point. It was custom built for Boulder Rural Station, I think, the old station. I don't think it's going to go anywhere. It's just something that's gone there to die. Again, it's just scrap.
I think it's scrap. Like you said, when did Boulder Rural move to their new fire station? That's when we got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was 8 years ago.
Is it installed or is it just laying around?
It's just laying around.
It's laying on the...
Well, goodbye.
Seems reasonable.
Yeah.
I'm just taking it to recycling tomorrow.
Uh-huh. Make it gold. random tires and wheels. Do they actually fit anything we have?
So I sent you guys an email at one point with everything, and honestly, every one of those tires is associated with a vehicle that we still own. There's one set of tires that are for the Red Command car, which are pretty much junk. There was or is a set of tires for the white Tacoma car, and that was over at Peak Imports getting its maintenance on. They said the tires had 8 holes in it and the rest of the tires weren't in that great of shape, so you're better off just trashing the tires. So those tires were gone. There's one tire I couldn't figure out where it went, but I mean, it's crazy that there's probably, I don't know, there's got to be at least 20 tires and wheels over there, and every one of them is associated with the vehicles that we have.
Okay.
So I know we just, NFPA made us replace tires on 01. Is that right? Because correct. They were gold.
On NFPA.
And I can't remember. What's that?
NFPA. I think it's DOT.
Okay. DOT. What are they saying as far as age? A lot of these tires that are garbage, they might be garbage and they just might be too old to put on a truck. Remember, all this equipment, as soon as we put a light bar and a siren on it, it may have to stop and, you know, and operate in much harsher conditions than, you know, we would otherwise, other than Charlie, everybody else would normally drive their vehicles.
There should be dates on the tires.
Yeah. But if they're... Yeah. If they have multiple patches and things like that, then we should not be running emergency vehicles on repurposed tires.
That's absolutely true. What I was saying is that all of the wheels and tires were in good shape. I didn't go through all the patches on them. You know, the ones that I said we should get rid of are the ones out of Command 2. Those were garbage, but, you know, all the other tires, as far as I can remember, have looked like they had good tread on them and they were in good shape.
I think a lot of that was because we put a better tire on the vehicle. Some of them came, are they, they're not mud and snow. They're just kind of a street tread, aren't they?
No, I don't go that far either.
But someplace we upgraded the tires for our rock conditions, our terrain, and I think that's where a lot of these came from.
Yeah, I can tell you the original set of wheels off of 5620, so the off-road Twinkie, That thing has better wheels and tires on it now, but the original over a station two.
But it's they now serve no purpose because we did a lift on that. Is that right?
No, we didn't do a lift. We just changed that. We put a little bit of bigger tire on it.
Oh, okay. But is there any point keeping them?
If we spent the money on buying, or you know, buying better off-road tires for a vehicle, I would assume if we're going to replace the tires on that vehicle, we're going to replace them with the same, like, better off-road tires and heavier tread. We wouldn't go backwards and go to, you know, the highway tires.
I just don't know if you want to keep them as spares. That's all. And also keep in mind, it's not very easy to get rid of tires up here. So that's a whole other.
Yeah, we'll have to pay to dispose of them now.
Yeah.
Check the dates, because chances are the majority are outdated anyway.
I mean, if that's, I have no problems. I just was asked to do the inventory, so that's what I did.
What if we start with the outdated tires? We know that those definitely won't be used. Let's see what we have left, and if there's any outside chance that they would be useful, we'll have that discussion. But let's just start out with getting rid of what we know we absolutely can't use.
So, I mean, I have no problem with that. The one question I have is, you know, the tires on 44, there's no way the tires on 44 are less than 10 years old. And that's spare tire. And right. I bet you those tires are like 1,500, $2,000 a pop.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They're actually not that much. I've shopped them. But I don't know the age of the ones they're selling.
Oh, I get you.
Well, wait a minute. 44 has them oversized tires on it already, doesn't it?
And that's not our truck. As far as I know, we don't.
Car service. No, wait a minute. Which one's 44? The rest is ours.
What's that?
I think the red one's ours. The yellow one is Forest Service.
I think we made some agreement with the Colorado Department of
Forestry.
Now I can't remember.
It's CDPHE now.
Yeah, CDFPC.
CDFPC. I knew it was one of them.
Well, right. It used to be the Colorado State Forest Service, but now they're part of the fire.
DFPC.
So anyway, I don't know if we technically even own that wheel, but that's a giant wheel that's taking up space over there.
And that's just like a single spare, did you say?
Yeah, it's a single spare that's the size of a
package. Yeah, no. I know how big it is. I put the chains on once.
So,
spare on the truck, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I don't want to spend too much time on this.
All right, I'll check the dates when I then have a chance. Yeah, I'll
check the dates. Let us know.
Okay.
I think we clarified most of that. We do need to come up with another policy, right, about how to dispose of items.
We add light bars to the disposal. We have a plethora of 1960s and 1970s light bars.
I would say most likely yes.
Do we have any light bars are in service right now that couldn't be in service if we got rid of all that vintage equipment?
How about this? How about I will single out the ones, if there are any that are on any vehicles, they will go on, you know, we'll pull them aside. But I mean, honestly, every vehicle that we're putting together, every light bar that we're replacing, we're putting in LED light.
LEDs.
Crappy old, I don't even know what the hell they are. It's not even a half.
I would say if
that stuff is
match, take care of me.
A lot of that stuff came from the sheriff's department.
Right.
I mean, it's crap. It's taking up so much space, and I'm sure it's housing small little friends as well.
I'm sold.
Can you think of any use for them with what we currently have?
I can't.
Is it similar to the exhaust system that we got from Boulder Rural?
Outdated.
What's that?
Older and more outdated.
Okay.
So yes, it was stuff that we got for free because someone else was throwing it in the dumpster.
I got no problem with it.
Okay. I believe that's a yes. Todd, have you just fallen asleep on us?
No. I think my leg is starting to bark at me a little bit.
Okay. No worries. Try and make this done. Unless anybody has an objection, I would go with yes.
I'm not.
Okay. In that case, two more pieces and we can get out of here. And these, I think, are very quick. There was a query about training costs for members. So like the St. Anthony Symposium and MSAC. I don't see that being an issue, given that it's budgeted and we would normally pay for those. And MSAC is like 25% of its normal price this year because it's all online. So unless anybody has any objections, I would say the usual policy, which is as long as you're an active member. Let me just hit that one. And yes, we will pay for your CEs. I think, Ryan, you brought that up to me today. If you let me know who that is, then we can discuss. But I don't see a problem with that. MSAC is incredibly useful. Sorry, Patrick.
It's what we've always done in the past. Is that correct? Nothing new?
Nothing new. Generally, most people don't go particularly to MSAC because it's 3 days. I used to go every year because it's really valuable. But yeah, I think of all of them, actually, MSAC is really good and worthwhile. So. And it's in the budget. Okay.
I'm okay with it.
I'm good with it, of course.
So you broke up a bit.
No, I'm good with it. You know.
Okay. Ray? Ray, you okay with that?
Oh, yeah.
So, and then the last one is we need two new firefighter helmets and crests for two of our people who have been here a few years and are using old helmets. Any objections to that? We we believe is around about $700, about $900 on here, just to, I did the Ryan to it and added some, so it would always come out less.
Say that again.
So we have two recruits that have been with us over 2 years who would like to make members. As part of that, provide them with new helmets. They're using old helmets and their own crests, which is what we normally do. So,
oh, okay.
Part of the rite of passage.
Yeah, I got
what it. What we used to do, at least. Yeah. Okay. So that's good. And then the other one's a kind of silly question, but 5617 is still down at Keter. Apparently they had to take it apart to figure out the part that they needed to order. Never been there with a truck. They can overnight it. The part itself is $357. They can overnight it for $200. Well, it's about $56 for ground, and it'll take about a week, which means we'd be without the engine till at least next Wednesday. Or ladder till at least next Wednesday. I would personally overnight it so we can get it back. But anybody else?
Is it a critical vehicle?
It's a ladder truck.
So it's the ladder, okay.
It's not critical until you need it.
Yeah.
Well,
like the rescue off that rock face, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's get her done.
Yes from Ray.
So, yes from me.
Yes from me.
So just a rundown, though. Once we get 5617 back, the only thing we would have left really to work on would be 5603. Is that right?
I believe so. Yes.
No, we still haven't gotten to the conclusion of 5624, which I think Chief's next pass was going to be send it down and put it on a dyno.
Okay. Interestingly, just as a side note, I drove that the other day up the hill to fuel it, and normally I could make it do the weird judder up that hill and it wouldn't do it for me. So I don't know what's going on there. Just throwing that in there to add some confusion to it, but sure, that one's still there on the list of things to think about. But the, I think 17 and 03 were the last things from the DOT stuff, I believe, in answer to your question, Patrick.
Yeah, I was just wanted to remark that good progress has been made and that the trucks are coming up to speed. So I just wanted to recognize the work that it has taken to get there. And I appreciate that. And I know the staff appreciates that. Along with that, I can't say that I have seen the any of the Netherland trucks look as clean as they do now. I haven't been to Station 3, so I don't know about that, but I appreciate the time and the effort you guys are putting into checking, maintaining, and ensuring that you have all the equipment on the rigs you need and cleaning them. They look fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah, I second that. And also, I just want to say thank you to Charlie for doing truck swaps with 5641 and 5617. Down to Keter. Really appreciate that. Thank you. Making that all done.
Well, in truck replacement, 24 has got to be pretty high on that list.
Yep.
Yeah. And so I think that goes along with budgeting and we got to really sit down and possibly even just have a separate meeting as it pertains to apparatus and equipment and figure out, you know, not just what we're going to need next year, but what do we need in the next 10 years and how are we going to get there? Mm-hmm. We really got to pin that down.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. We can. Yeah, we should probably do a work session about vehicle replacement plans. Okay.
Well, it does sound kind of sounded like the state isn't going to help us with vehicles again.
I think that's untrue. It just depends where we go. When we got the brush truck, that was kind of like the back door that closed behind us when we got that. But there are some other venues I can go after.
Okay. Let us know, because that's looming. For sure. Okay. Is there any public comment? Okay, gonna give it no. No special executive session, no conclusions. I would suggest that we adjourn this meeting, and I hope the next one won't be this long. I know I say that every time. but we kind of had a lot of backed up in this one. So I propose we adjourn this meeting at 9:49 p.m.
I second.
Patrick, you good with that?
Yep.
Cool. Okay. Well, thank you everybody for working through all of that. This is obviously a period of unknowns. We have no policy to work through and no previous plan to work on. So I appreciate all the time and effort that you're putting in to move this forward and keep things working, and particularly to the shift officers for all the effort that they are putting in to keeping everything running.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll talk to you all soon. Take care.
Night.
Night.